Community outreach and accessibility research and intervention, call 979-308-6407 to learn more. That number is 979-308-6407 to join the Houston chapter of ADAPT and advocate for the civil rights of people with disabilities. All ADAPT actions are nonviolent.
Pulsating Beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch. That means it's 8 p.m. on a Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and storytelling. Right here on KPFD 90.1 FM. Well, I'm your guest host this evening, Eric Heen, and along with our regular hosts, Drs. Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, and Greg Audell, and our engineer and media guru, Tatiana Gago, we bring you the power of story. We do this by placing the spotlight on guests who take us on journeys through windows of their souls before bringing us back safely to the present. I have an important announcement to make. A few moments ago, three police officers entered our studio and surrounded me. But they're not here to arrest anybody. They are our guests this evening on So What's Your Story? And when I said the words police officers, I bet you envisioned a bunch of big, brawny men. But our guests tonight are all police women. And their unique perspectives on the life of a cop will fuel our stories tonight. No matter how you feel about the police, I think we can all agree that open communication between the police and the rest of us is a good thing. Now, my guests here, they're street cops, but they also participate in a lot of outreach programs to try to improve relations between the police and the community in general. And what better way to do that than by sharing their stories with us this evening? My three guests are Sarah Cortez from here in Houston, Treva Mott, also from Houston, and a special thanks to Susanna Sanchez, who traveled here from Austin just to be on our show. Welcome to the three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eric.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You bet. Well, our first storyteller will be Treva Mott from the Houston Police Department. Officer Mott is a native Houstonian, and after serving honorably in the U.S. Navy, she returned to Houston. She holds a bachelor's degree in mass communications and journalism and a master's degree in media communications with an emphasis in public relations from the Norfolk State University. In 2008, Treva joined the Houston Police Department, and after doing patrol duty, she transferred to the HPD Department of Public Affairs. And her focus is now on keeping youth off the streets and out of jail. And what better focus can there be? Now, Treva, you told me you also, even though you're in public affairs, you also, like once a week, they put you back in a squad car and put you back out on the street. Is that the case?
Yes.
They just keep you not too far from the nitty-gritty then?
Most definitely.
Okay. Okay. Now, Treva, you told me that you're involved with a program called Coffee with a Cop. Now, what could you tell us a little bit about that? What is it?
Yes, Coffee with a Cop is just one of the activities that we do in public affairs, and it involves the community coming in. Let's just say, for example, at McDonald's. And what we do is we invite the community in to sit down with us and to discuss some of the issues or concerns that they may have that's going on in their community.
Great.
And we actually do have coffee.
Ah, and this is the ultimate police cliche, but I bet you have donuts with that coffee.
Maybe.
Okay. Well, let's get to your first story, Treva. But before we start, I want to warn our listeners that parts of the story might be a bit graphic, but I think it's an important story to tell. So, Treva, let's hear your first story.
Well, my first story, one that's extremely memorable, is when I remember I got a call. I worked on the northeast side of town, 10 p.m. to 8 a.m. I received a call right around 1:20, 1:30 a.m., and it was a shooting, and it was involving a teenager. So I was like, okay, wow. I'm thinking a kid was playing with a gun. I'm thinking maybe a toe, a foot, a hand, something. So what I did was, you know, of course, I prepared myself for this scene. So when I arrived, I noticed the lady was sitting out in the driveway in a wheelchair to my left. And I said, is everything okay? I asked her questions. She said, yes, everything is okay. The children are in the house. And I was thinking, oh, okay, well, it's not that serious then. So I walked in and I noticed a trail of blood. As I walked in the living room, I also noticed there were about four teenagers laughing and talking and watching television, which concerned me. So some of the officers that came to back me up, I asked them to just kind of stand there and watch the children. So, excuse me, the young teenagers. And so I went on and I just followed the trail of blood. And as I opened the room door, I noticed blood was a pool of blood on the floor next to the bed. I noticed the shotgun. And as I looked up and looked on the wall, I noticed there was some brain matter. I was like, okay. In my mind, I'm thinking, okay, well, the ambulance have come and taken the child away. It was very serious. But as I listened closely, I can hear a gurgling sound like... And I was like, oh my gosh, what is that? So I opened the door more and I saw a young man lying on the floor in a pool of blood, breathing, alive. Okay, so again, my heart started pounding extremely hard and I was like, oh my gosh, this is, oh my gosh. So I ran out real quick. I told the officers, separate the kids. I don't want to hear anything. I don't want to hear a sound. And at this time, the ambulance had come in. They did what they needed to do to take the young man to the hospital. I ran outside and I said, something is not strange. Something is strange because the lady that I saw in the driveway was so calm. So I asked her, I went back out and I spoke to her. I said, what time did you hear a gunshot go off? And she said, oh, around 12:35, 12:40. Okay, so I went back to my shop and I said, but I didn't get the call until 1 something. So things start, you know, going off in my head and it was saying, hey, something isn't right. So I went back in and I began my interview with each teenager. And all of their stories were actually the same. So that told me that something else went on in that home. That they sat there and they discussed what they were going to say while this young man was lying in the room, back room, dying. Or so they thought. So one of the toughest things about that story is that I have children. I had a son that age. So it touched me in such a way, wow, what do I tell the mother if she walks up to this scene? And of course, she walked up. I couldn't allow her in. All I could do was tell her to go to the hospital. And she went. And at that time, you know, all the statements were taken. And I followed protocol. I did everything that I was supposed to do. But what really concerned me is that, you know, I had to go home. I had to see my son that night. So, of course, I did the proper protocol by calling out and dispatch allowed me. And I went home and I just wanted to see my son. I had to see him. I gave him a hug and went back out on the street. But I couldn't sleep. And for a few days had gone by. And I had to go by and see him. I had to see what happened to that young man. And he was still alive. I went to the hospital. His mother allowed me in the room. And I was able to see him. He was alive. Again, they had stitched his head up. And I was able to rest at that point. But I could not sleep without knowing what happened to that young man.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. So that's interesting that you followed up on, you didn't have to go visit him, but it was a victim there and you
yes.
were involved in the case, so you just felt like you had to go.
Yes, yes indeed.
Okay. Is there anything in p- particular message that you'd like our listeners to get from that story? Any?
Absolutely. You know, as parents, we should know who our children are hanging around. A lot of times we think, oh, not my child. But this young man was hanging around a crowd that played with guns. They were on the other side of the law. Mm-hmm. And so I'm almost certain that his parents didn't know that his friends played with guns and may have possibly did a lot of illegal activity.
Mm-hmm. Do you know whatever happened to him?
No, I did not follow up.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you, Treva. I appreciate that. Our next storyteller is Sarah Cortez. Sarah is a law enforcement veteran of 24 years. She's a Rice graduate and holds two advanced degrees from UT and U of H. And Sarah is also a writer and the winner of the Penn Texas Literary Award. And get this, she's been a finalist to be the Poet Laureate of Texas. Her memoir is entitled Tired, Hungry, Standing in One Spot for 12 Hours. And some of her stories tonight will come straight out of that book. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you.
Now, it wasn't mentioned in your bio here, Sarah, but I happen to know that you were in the corporate world for about 15 years, making tons of money. Then you suddenly gave all that up to be a cop. So why, in the name of thunder and Zeus, would anyone give up that much money to become a cop?
Oh, Eric, it's because there's so many other things in the world that are so much more important than money. Public service, following your heart about how to make the world a better place, and doing what all of us cops do. We take an oath of office to die, if we need to, for complete strangers. I mean, there's nothing better than public service, whether it's military, fire, EMS, or, well, I think the best of all of them is policing. So,
mm-hmm. You're not biased?
I'm not biased at all.
No. Okay, well, your first story has to do with how cops develop special attachments to their equipment. And how you don't like it when other people tamper with your equipment. So can you tell us that story?
Sure. You know, Eric, cops need to be attuned to their equipment. I mean, think about it. Your life as a police officer or someone else's may depend on a piece of equipment working right the first time. Because guess what? You may not get a second chance. So you can see why cops develop intense relationships with pieces of equipment. Equipment are tools. Inanimate objects made of steel or leather, maybe glass, nylon, cotton, brass, polymer. These are the tools of our trade. The knife that you need to cut the seatbelt to free a person from a burning vehicle. How about the brakes or steering system in your police car? Your ears learn the music of your tools, those on your body, your boots, gun belt, handcuff, keys, but also the music of those on your car brakes, the chassis, the tires, the windshield wipers. So my personal no-holds-barred favorite piece of equipment in my entire 24 years of policing is my Crown Vic. Oh, it's wide in the hips and low to the ground. No other car rides a curve as smooth or with as much throaty V8 as a Crown Victoria from the Ford Motor Company. It's got a deep trunk to hold a patrol bag, fingerprint case, evidence bag, hard copies of a million forms, recording system, and spare tire. And, you know, my list of the Crown Vic's charms could be endless. But the story I tell tonight is one of my favorite Crown Vic stories. And since you now know, Eric and everyone else, you now know a patrol officer's unique relationship to his or her patrol vehicle, you'll have an insider's appreciation of this tale. My car share worked deep nights, I worked evenings, so the car sat vacant during day shift. The lady living next to the substation fed throngs of stray cats. One winter morning, when my car share took his gear out of the car, he must have left a door open. A stray cat climbed in unnoticed. Understandable, because it was below freezing and the heater had been on, so the car was toasty warm inside. When I came on duty at 1400 hours, the entire inside of the car, from windshield to MDT to seats to floorboards, was covered in I couldn't even run any calls for service. I had to take it to be cleaned immediately. For months, even years after, I would find catnip hanging from my rearview mirror or cat food cans in my mailbox at the station. Yep, cops have long memories for the funny stuff.
So, it's despite popular belief, cops do have a sense of humor, huh?
Oh, Eric, we have to have one in order to survive the job.
You know, I saw something on Facebook a while back. It was these pictures. It was a traffic accident, and nobody was hurt in the accident, but a donut truck got burnt up, caught on fire. All the donuts were destroyed. And the cops had this little photo op there. They're just mourning the loss of these donuts. And other police departments even got in on the fun. They're sending their condolences for the loss of your donuts. I think that shows that cops can laugh at themselves. That's a good thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Got to laugh at ourselves.
Yes.
My third guest took time from her busy schedule to come here from Austin. Susana Sanchez is the daughter of Colombian immigrants. She graduated from the prestigious McCombs School of Business in Austin. While interning at the U.S. Justice Department, Susana suddenly decided to become a city police officer, and she's now a member of the Austin Police Department. Thanks for being here, Susana.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Great. I see you initiated a calendar in Austin there, and it features police women from the Austin Police Department. Could you tell us a little bit about this project?
Absolutely. About 2 years ago, I noticed that public service calendars were starting to come out again, and they were all the usual public service calendar. You know, firefighters with no shirts, raising money for whatever charities, which is a great idea. But I thought, why isn't that women are not accurately represented in this kind of project? And I mean not women in sports bras or women posing in a sensual fashion, but I wanted to show the true female heroes that work as police officers. So a detective who's a good friend of mine now, and I, we started this project to capture women in action, to capture them training for the job, to capture them at the shooting range, trying to be the best police officer they can be. And we caught some fantastic images that showed women of all races and backgrounds and job paths within the police department. So that became a great project of mine.
And all the proceeds go to local charities, correct?
Absolutely.
Great. Well, Susana, you told me earlier that domestic abuse calls are some of the most common calls that cops get. And your first story is about a really scary abuse situation. Could you tell us that story?
Absolutely, Eric. Well, as you may know, domestic abuse calls and traffic stops are some of the most dangerous things that police officers can face on a daily basis. Unfortunately, they're the most common calls that we also have. When I was freshly released off my field training period, I responded to a domestic violence call, which we called a hotshot, meaning the most serious call that you can get. And I remember the call tech saying that a husband was chasing his wife around the house with a knife and was trying to kill her. I was by myself in my patrol unit, and it was probably 11 o'clock at night. I had no backup coming for me because everybody was busy. And I remember hearing the radio, the dispatcher, tell me, "We have history in that house for weapons, we have a history of mental illness. That man who this woman is calling about has a history of being violent. So I'm coming into the most dangerous situation a cop can come into aside from a shooting. And as I'm driving up to this hilly neighborhood, I realize that the terrain is completely against me. I had never been here before. This was at a time when ambush attacks were on the rise on police officers. So if anybody with any sense of a gun wanted to have the drop on me, they could have definitely have taken me out as soon as I got out of my patrol unit. So with my heart pounding and my thoughts racing and me trying to figure out what exactly I was going to do if anything hit the fan, I got out, drew my gun, and started moving among the trees as fast as I could, thinking as long as I keep moving, I'm a hard target to hit. So I finally get to where the house is, and I locate it. There's some steps going down to the front door and to an alleyway where I see a man sitting in a chair, and his hands are in his pockets. Now, when you're a police officer and you're training, or you're training as a cadet, the first thing they tell you is watch the hands. You don't know what's in pockets. You don't know what's in waistbands. If somebody wants to shoot you, they will be able to shoot you first. So I saw him with his hands in his pockets, and I started giving him commands, coming down the stairs and yelling loudly, "Austin Police, show me your hands, show me your hands." When I got to the bottom of the stairs, I hear somebody whimpering behind me, and it's the female who called us. It's the wife, and she's sitting like a child, almost in a fetal position. So I put myself between her and the man, and it's crazy. When you're in that moment, everything kind of goes silent. Imagine yourself sinking into a pool. Your senses just become so focused on that one object. Suddenly, I felt somebody tap me on the shoulder, and my supervisor had made it to my scene. I didn't even realize. He made it there, and he said, "I got you. I got you." So we walked up, and I put my gun at a low ready position, and we managed to get this man in handcuffs. As we searched the house, because the lady gave us permission, we saw that he had built a fort inside his room, and that there was a loaded revolver behind that fort. What he had done it for, I don't know, nor do I want to know, but I think I have an idea. As I came out and the adrenaline is dropping finally, the female comes up to me, the caller, and she tells me something I'm never going to forget. She says, "You have no idea how good it felt to hear you come down those stairs." Mm-hmm. And that's something that stuck with me for the rest of my career.
Mm. That really gives us something to think about, Susanna. Is there a message in that story that you'd like to convey to our listeners?
Absolutely. Things could have been very different had this male had his revolver on him, had he made that choice to bring it out with him. Realize that when we show up to these scenes, we are making decisions in less than a fraction of a second, and things could have been different.
Mm-hmm. And the way that woman seemed to really appreciate your presence.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, those are the calls that keep you coming back to your job day in and day out.
Great. Okay, thanks, Susanna. And Treva, your next story has to do with how a cop's actions can have an effect on young people's lives, especially at-risk youth.
Yes.
And I think we would love to hear that story.
All right. Well, I have the opportunity. I work with a program. I'm the liaison for a program called TAPS, Teen and Police Service Academy. And we work with at-risk youth. The program is designed to close the social distance between law enforcement and at-risk youth. And now it's youth, because we're finding that it's very important that everyone know how to interact with law enforcement. So this particular story, I went into a youth facility, juvenile facility, and as an officer, we go in and we teach different curriculums. And this particular topic could have been teen and, let's say dating violence, something to that nature, because we have many topics that we go over with the youth. So we got off topic, and I asked a young man, I stated, "Well, okay, so how many of you all want to go to jail? Let me see a show of hands." So I see three guys, they raise their hand. They're between the ages of 13 and 16. So I see two guys raise their hand. So I said, you guys really want to go to jail? But I saw the laughter. They were laughing and kidding. I'm like, you know, okay, it's not a laughing matter. But, you know, I knew they were clowning. So they put their hands down. But the young man to my right, I noticed he didn't put his hand down. And I looked at him and I said, you really want to go to jail? And he said, well, that's where his father is. And he stated that his mother didn't care anything about him and he didn't know where she was. And who cared? Was his question. And I looked at him and the room was completely silent. And I looked at him face to face and I said, I care. That's who care. So I asked this young man, I said, well, when you get out of this facility, I'll give your instructors and the people that work there my information, my work information. And when you get out and you go back to school, have your grandmother to give me a call. I'll go to school and check up on you. I'll help you with your homework. But please contact me because I care about you. I don't want to see you lost. I see potential in you. And that's the message that I wanted to get to that young man. And he looked at me and he believed me. And I wanted him to. He heard the sincerity in my voice. And they all, after the 11th week, it's an 11-week program, they graduate. And I was at another event at the time of their graduation. And one of their instructors came to me and she said, I wish you would have been here when they graduated. That young man wrote a letter about you and had everyone in here in tears because he never had anyone to show that much concern and mean it. So she said, thank you very much. So that made me feel really good and proud about what I'm doing.
That's awesome.
That's great.
Thank you.
Well, so have you followed up with that young man? Have you ever, do you know what's with how he's doing now?
Well, we have to wait until they notify us because he's still in juvenile lockup.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, we're pulling for him.
Yes, we are.
That's great. Okay, we're going to take a break from our police stories now, and we're going to hear from Dr. Hank Rubicek. For those of you who haven't heard our program, Dr. Hank is the founder and producer of So What's Your Story? And he's got an important message of a personal nature for us tonight. Dr. Hank, are you there?
I am here, Eric. Thank you very much for taking a couple of minutes. And do I have about 30 seconds to respond to the stories that we're listening to tonight?
You definitely do. Sure.
You know, Eric knows this, and all three of you. Fine professionals should know that law enforcement is important to me. I trained at HPD, and that's why, Sarah, I think we met each other. It was a long time ago. Now I know I'm 39, but I think I was much younger then. Yeah, only kidding. I think we met a long time ago. I used to train at HPD a long, long time ago, and for about 15 years, and I also taught classes at LEMIT, the Law Enforcement Management Institute. I'm not sure, but we'll talk later. And I love these stories tonight, Eric. This was just a great, great roundup of narratives. You know, for every single PR or case study depicting a problematic police officer, there are about 200 cases that showcases the very best, most creative problem solvers that we're ever going to find. You had mentioned domestic disturbances earlier, which are so difficult to field. And after riding with officers for 15 years, I've been on death notification calls, which are heart-wrenching, and that's probably the least descriptive that I can come up with. I've heard officers field situations where you have elderly women who are hearing voices of their late husbands in the attic, officers who are fielding stolen bicycles. What officers do best is to deal with the community on a very raw interpersonal level. They're good listeners. They're problem solvers. They make decisions. And for one, I really wish that we would talk a lot more about that. So I applaud these stories tonight. I really do appreciate it so much. I used to be a hostage negotiator in another life, as Eric knows, a long, long time ago. So I have great respect. The issue about this personal thing that's happening with me, I had a very good friend who passed last Thursday. His name was Michael Lublein, and he and I knew each other since we were 3.5 years old. We kept in contact all of these years, and it was one of the most wonderful times that I've ever spent connecting with anyone. And for 1 week before he died, I called him every day and we talked about things. And at the end of every conversation, Eric, I think I mentioned this to you, he ended it with, make sure you call me tomorrow with another story. Now, I didn't know I told him stories, but apparently I did. But it was the story that kept him going. I'm not suggesting that stories kept him alive, but stories kept him smiling and laughing and listening. And there was something very sustaining about that. I wrote the following to give to his wife to deliver at a eulogy that I could not attend. And it's long, but I just gave a quick synthesized version, and here it is. I was unable to attend Mike's funeral. However, it's no hyperbole when I say that my heart is lost, but my heart is there. I've known Mike since we were 3 and a half. Almost every significant childhood episode consisted of some involvement with him. I could give you a rundown of our goofy escapades, but most important, Mike and I resurrected many of them every day for a week before he died. We started by naming every kid in our K through third grade class pictures. He knew quite a few. Unfortunately, he also remembered me peeing in my pants in kindergarten and told me how embarrassed he was to know me. I was 5, Mike, I said. It was still embarrassing, he responded, but I gave you another chance. Mike told me how much he loved playing ball in the street because it was safe. We slept over each other's houses all the time and looked forward to tuna sandwiches and French fries served up generously by his dad the next day. He told me how much he loved my grandparents, and I told him how much they loved him. I asked him the day before he died, what was your favorite moment in life? Unflinchingly, he replied, the day Mitchell came home. That's his son. He adopted him. The day before Mike passed, I asked him to give me a sign that he's all right once he settles down with everyone who loves him and are waiting for him. And he said he would. I look forward to it, Mike. Our lives, simply put, are a series of stories. They're moments frozen in time, and when we tell them, we let them thaw and unfold into recollections that define us. We're born a blank page. Every life is our story, and our story is our life. Something is happening in the moment, and we don't yet know it. We're just in it. We live in a story like fish lives in water. We swim through words and images, siphoning story through our minds the way a fish siphons water through its gills. That's what Mike and I did together all of our lives, and put it in gear a few days before he died. Every word Michael Lublein conveyed had meaning, and every action carried love. He had honor and dignity and knew how to protect the dignity of those who surrounded him. That isn't my impression, that's a fact, because Mike effortlessly stretched the boundaries of the human heart. So thank you, Mike, for giving me that chance after embarrassing you in kindergarten. And thank you for the honor of letting me be a participant in the story of your life. We'll see each other again. Peace, my friend. I love you.
Wow.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. And I told his wife that I would be offering some words tonight. So right. I do appreciate that.
Well, thank you. I think that shows the power of story, what we're all about here.
Yep.
Your friendship was encompassed in stories. Well, our thoughts go out to Michael's family and loved ones. Now, on a lighter note here, I have a happy announcement to make. Dr. Hank here is receiving the Finley Stewart Storytellers Trailblazing Award at the big annual storytelling festival this weekend in Denton. And to show you how big of a deal this is, they haven't given anyone this award since 2011. I think like every time Halley's Comet comes around, they give somebody this award. So we're
Halley's Comet. That must be it. Right. That must be it. Yes.
Yes.
It's thank you. You know, it's I don't even know much about the award at all, but I'm very honored. And it's for the Tejas Storytelling Festival. And they're a good group. It's about the third largest storytelling group in the country. It's a Texas storytelling organization. And yeah, it deals with doing something in the world of storytelling that no one has done before, and let it manifest into something very special. They're referring to the show, I think, I hope, because I'm not sure I've done anything else worth noting. But in any event, it will be very, 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 very pleasant. Warren Holloman, I want to thank him, Dr. Holloman, our yes. co-host on the show. He wrote me a letter and of recommendation, and I didn't know that until I won. And I'm very honored. I am very honored. It's a very nice treat. Thank you for mentioning that.
You bet. We're head over heels proud of you, Dr. Hank, here.
Congratulations.
Okay. Tatiana, my friend, are you there?
Yes. A lot of emotions here tonight. A lot to reflect about.
Do you want a hanky?
Yes, please.
Well, Tatiana, I hear that when it comes to storytelling, we're not the only game in town. Can you fill us in on the other storytelling venues in Houston like only you can do?
Of course. Let's first talk about our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild meets the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emanuel at 1500 Sunset for a story swap. You can come and just enjoy the stories, or you can tell a story of your own. It's a friendly, supportive group and the best place to learn to discover the storyteller in you. When you go to www.houstonstorytellers.org, you will not only find about the great activities they sponsor, but when you click on the radio program tab, you'll see the menu of all of our shows dating back to 2008. Over 450 programs originating from our humble little KPFD studio. Remember, So What's Your Story is live every week, and if you don't have a radio, it's not an excuse, because you can listen to us on kpft.org, stream live from any place in the world. How cool is that? Also, watch us on Facebook Live and visit us on our Facebook page, and we'd love it if you like us when you leave. And we are also on YouTube. When you think about it, we're all over the place. And our friends at The Moth are more fun than the law allows every second Tuesday of the month. But this month, it's going to be on the third Tuesday. It's going to be on March 19th, and the theme is magic. It's at Warehouse Live, and I promise you will have a ball. It'll be a magical night.
Great. Well, thank you, Tatiana, for filling us in on the remainder of the storytelling universe. So did you notice I'm surrounded by police officers, Tatiana? So we better be on our best behavior tonight here, because we're surrounded by police officers.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm innocent, I promise.
Okay. No, they're great. They're great. Okay, now, ladies, before we... first of all, next week on So What's Your Story, Mary Edgerton will host attorney Carrie Blakinger with stories about faulty justice right here on KPFT 90.1. And that'll be an interesting transition from tonight's program, Faulty Justice. Now, ladies, before we get back to your cop stories, I have a confession to make.
Uh-oh, we have our handcuffs ready.
Uh-oh.
Yes.
Well, go easy on me. Okay, my confession is I used to be a cop. Well, sort of. I was a military policeman in the U.S. Army. This was a long time ago. It's before I realized that I was too neurotic to be a cop. But the reason I'm telling you this story is because when I joined the Army, women were not allowed to be military police. There were no, it was all men. And by the time I got out, about 3 years later, they had started allowing women in. So I got to see the very first women MPs in the U.S. Army. And I can tell you unequivocally that that was the best thing that ever happened to the U.S. Army Military Police Corps, because we were out of control. When the women came in, things got professional. Things got had more class there. So I'm going to put you all on the spot here. Imagine your own police departments. If they suddenly removed all the women, how would things be different?
I would say without a woman's touch, chaotic.
Well, women tend to be better with details. Men tend to be really awesome with upper body strength, logical progression. And I think these are gross overgeneralizations, so they're always wrong in many cases. But, women smell better.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't complain when they allowed women in.
It's definitely better to have females to talk to certain kinds of victims, I want to say. Men tend to have a very difficult time talking to victims of sexual assault, for example. So it's a little bit easier for those victims to talk to females sometimes. It definitely helps victims.
Yes. Right.
Women bring balance.
I would say so.
Bring a balance.
And it's just I wouldn't want to work in an organization that's completely female. Mm-hmm. Either, I think. I like the balance between what men bring and what women bring on the whole.
So we men are worth something there, I guess.
Well, you guys make it a great time. Don't get me wrong.
Okay. Great. We're doing great things for gender relations here.
Yes.
Okay, now, Sarah, let's get back to you. You have a story about a police canine unit. Let's hear that story.
All righty. Well, you know, Eric, cops are always learning from each other. Often by listening to stories of what happened on other calls for service. It's an informal but vitally important way to relay information from officer to officer. And don't forget, things on the streets change quickly. If we police waited for textbooks to be written, edited, and printed in order to learn, we'd all be dead. Street culture and street gangs, criminals, change and adapt quickly. So here's one of my favorite stories. It's also humorous. It was told to me by one of my field training officers when I was a fairly new officer transferring in from another department. This call dropped for a burglary of habitation in progress. I got there. A huge house, so spread out that the bedrooms were in different zip codes. Three or four other units arrived, including a canine unit and his dog. So we're all searching through this house in the dark, all spooked because there was an open door and we didn't know where the bad guys were. We searched everywhere, you know, each closet, bathroom, shower stall, pantry, under the beds and overhead in the closets, even in the attic, and it checked clear. By that time, the homeowners arrived. We're standing in this big dish of a sunken living room with white Italian leather couches everywhere, and suddenly the canine, a German Shepherd, a beautiful dog, coughs. A white feather floats out of his mouth. He keeps coughing. And more feathers rise to the ceiling. Turns out that dog had eaten some expensive bird on a perch in the sunroom.
Wow.
A white cockatiel. Man, those people were pissed. And the PD had to pay for the bird.
Wow.
So I guess the moral of that story is to always feed your police dog before a call, right?
Right. And don't. And
we could save a lot of birds that way.
We could save a lot of birds. And heaven forbid, you know, you have to perform a Heimlich maneuver on your German Shepherd.
Or your cockatiel.
Or your cockatiel.
Thank you, Sarah. Susanna, now when I talked to you before, you said that real life police work is a lot different than how it's depicted on TV and in movies. It's a little bit less glamorous than Charlie's Angels. So how is it different?
Absolutely. Like you said, it's a whole lot less glamorous. Every day you must be ready to come back dirty and gross. You don't know if you're going to have to be standing out in a dusty driveway with a crash. You don't know who you're going to have to search. And believe me, Eric, when I say not everybody showers every week. You also might end up covered in sweat, your own sweat or blood or God knows what.
Mm-hmm.
I think I gotta say my best friend is the EMS gloves. Whenever I run out of those, I'm in a frantic panic.
Mm-hmm.
Or what about when somebody vomits on you?
I've had that happen a couple times.
Yeah. I think we all have, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think your next story, Susanna, might debunk a lot of that Charlie's Angels nonsense. Let's hear it.
All right, so my first night on FTO, my first night on the job, I had managed to pull two arrests already, and I was full of information. My FTO's throwing information at me left and right. And Eric, when you go into any new job, you have a lot of information in your brain, and you're overloaded. But this kind of information can mean the difference between your life, a death, somebody getting injured, so it's doubly important that you get every detail right. So I'm tired, and the last call is they needed us to help on I-35, the highway on the upper deck, to shut down a lane. So we drive up there, my FTO tells me, just turn on the lights, put on your seatbelt, and we're going to sit here. And I say, well, sir, the car's not moving. He says, well, yes, but if somebody hits you, you're going to need your seatbelt. I say, okay, so I put on my seatbelt. We had put out a couple cones before. There were some cones behind us. And finally, we hear over the radio, okay, guys, the crash has been cleared up. You can pick up the cones. So we get out of the car. I walk over. I start picking up cones on I-35. I pick up one, all right, walk to the next one, and I'm bending over to pick the second one up, and I can hear something clearly in my head saying, look up. I don't know if it was God, I don't know if it was the universe, or my grandma, or my conscience, but I looked up and I see these headlights barreling at me, probably between 50 to 60 miles an hour. It's kind of hard to measure how fast a car is coming at you at that point. So I drop the cone, I jump out of the way. My FTO jumps out of the way too, and the sedan rolls over the cone I had just dropped. It keeps going, and it stops inches short of hitting our patrol vehicle. Well, we pull the driver out. He's a young kid. He's drunk. He had been smoking pot. He had no idea what he was doing. What I got from that was look up, always be vigilant, and you never know when things are about to get difficult.
Wow. That was your first day on the job?
That was my first night on the job.
Welcome to police work, huh?
Yes, and I'm glad to still be here with you, because if I hadn't looked up, I may not be.
Well, we're glad you survived, too, Susanna. Thanks for that story. Now, Treva, your third story is about how innocent bystanders sometimes try to get involved with the cop's work. And sometimes they're helpful, but sometimes they kind of get in the way. I suppose sometimes they actually do more harm than good. So let's hear that story.
Yes. I would have to say, okay, I was knighted, of course, working night shift. And a call dropped that a citizen had other citizens at gunpoint. It's like, okay, this is different. So come to find out that the individuals that the citizen had holding them at gunpoint, come to find out, after speaking with him, getting the scene secure, I was nervous because I had never had to deal with a citizen holding other citizens at gunpoint. So I called my supervisor. What do I do? He tells me everything I need to do. Scene made the scene safe so that I'm the only one with a weapon. So long story short, I sat up here and I was like, well, what happened? Why would you hold these gentlemen at gunpoint? Mind you, we already had the guys pulled out of the truck, had them in the back of the other police cars because the other officers had come, but it seemed like it took forever. But anyway, so I'm standing there and I'm asking what happened. And he said he observed the gentleman driving erratically on the freeway and they caused a major accident and they kept going. So he decided that he would follow them because they had no intention to stop. So he followed them all the way across town and stopped in a dead end. And it seems it was dark. It seemed like it's no light. You know, I'm tunnel vision at this point. Still, you know, all my mind is just going everywhere. So it was just perplexing to me to see that another individual, and he really had them at gunpoint and they stayed in that driveway and they would not move. And you know, he was like, well, you know, he showed me all his credentials. He used to be law enforcement, and I thanked him for it. But he had several guns that I had to get from him and lock up in my trunk until backup arrived. But you know, I must say I really appreciate the citizens that we do have that are pro-police. They want to assist us. They want to help us. They know the dangers that we're in. And they know most of the time we're by ourselves. So to know that we have citizens out there that are truly on our side, I say thank you.
You know, if I were a cop and I came across somebody holding a gun on somebody else, I would think automatically it was the guy with the gun who would be the problem.
Well, you know, having a great HPD dispatchers, they actually gave me a great description. So I already knew who was supposedly, but again, approaching every situation, every scene from a safety perspective. Me, I trust no one. So I had to make sure that even though dispatch said, you know, the citizen that's holding them at gunpoint, they gave a great description, you know, vehicle description, everything from head to toe, who were the ones that he followed. I mean, he gave them drivers like how many was in the car. He gave them a great description of himself as well as the ones that he had followed.
Okay. Well, what advice would you give our listeners if they're in the midst of a crime scene and they want to get involved or something? Do you have any advice of how far they should go or any kind of general advice you can give them?
I would have to say it all depends on the different scenes because citizens can be great witnesses from a safe distance. And it's okay if they do pull out their phones and videotape us at a safe distance. Comply and do what the officer says to.
Great.
And actually, Eric, if you look at the national statistics for the past several years about the number of off-duty police officers killed in America, there's a very large percentage of off-duty police officers killed in America because they are out of uniform, they're at the bank or the restaurant or wherever, and criminals come in to do an armed robbery, and the police officer thinks he or she, it's happened to both men and women, they can stop the armed robbery, and they wind up getting killed. Mm-hmm. So even for police who are off duty, it can be very, very dangerous to try to stop other people who are armed.
Yeah. Well, this is a dark subject. It's not too much fun to talk about, but that kind of leads us into your next story.
Oh, geez.
Because one thing...
I think that's why she said that.
That could be a segue. But you see, one thing cops have to deal with more than the rest of us is death, like car accidents, murders, and so forth. But I think one reason to talk about it here is to try to learn how to avoid preventable deaths. So your next story, I think, covers that subject quite powerfully.
Well, let's see what you think, Eric. Let's see what you think. And the title of the story is Acquainted with Death. The busy maggots, bloated body cavities, and thickened necks. This dirty version of death is an unfortunate reality for cops. Our blood leaking, spraying across our faces and up our noses when we inhale, dripping down our shirts, trousers, and ornate silver badges. Sometimes bone fragments, severed fingers, feet, ears, or entire heads. We don't get the Mr. Clean version of death. Granted, not every shift, not every call for service, but death's presence is always waiting, always lurking behind the door or dented dumpster, inside the cheap-walled mobile home or just behind the tree line's black lace. Death is always looking to jump out and grab someone. Any excuse will work. Jealousy, anger, love, hatred, perhaps inattention, incompetency, immaturity, mechanical failure are just the luck of the draw. Ballpoint pens, hatchets, nylon cord, feather pillows that spew curlicued chicken feathers that make the crime scene techs sneeze. Maybe the hardware used is a hammer, ice pick, scissors, or a 2x4. Baseball bat, socket wrench, tennis racket, brick. Any favorable junction of motive and weapon, any entry wound, any kind of weather, any time of day or night, in lavender dusk or in pink promise of sunrise, in sunshine or wispy fog, death is always waiting to ferry someone into final darkest night. So there are some DOAs that no amount of ice can help an officer work. I think about the big big city veteran arson investigator whose every call for almost 20 years involved a burnt up corpse or burned up car. Sometimes both. He told me that he could still see the face of a lovely white female teen who died of smoke inhalation because the facility holding her had given her the wrong advice about what to do in the case of fire. They told her she could break the window panes plate glass with a chair. But the glass didn't break, couldn't break, because it was plexiglass. Her mascara and eyeliner still intact, her ethereal face serene, as if she didn't mind dying. Small hands with pink painted nails crossed over her chest. This is what he told me. He said, "I'm still angry about it. It's been 15 years and I'm still pissed." She followed their advice and tried to break the window with a chair multiple times, but she couldn't. You see, it's these kinds of scenes that police officers carry around with them all the time. They're burned into our brains and the backs of our eyelids. These are the things we carry around inside all the time, on and off duty.
Hmm. Wow. Thanks so much, Sarah. Well, that's our stories for tonight. And you may have noticed that we didn't get in any serious political discussions about police. There are plenty of other programs to do that. What we did is we just heard from three police women sharing a little bit of their lives with us. And let's keep the lines of communication open with the police and with everybody. Okay, thank you all for being here. You know, tomorrow is International Women's Day, and it seems like the whole world celebrates that day except America. I mean, I've been overseas. Everybody, it's a big day everywhere else. People hardly know it's International Women's Day here. So I'd like to thank you all for being here. And your stories have spotlighted the excellence in women in law enforcement. I really believe that. Do you have any parting thoughts for us?
Well, thank you, Eric, for having us here. We really appreciate the opportunity to tell our stories to the public. And I want to remind the listeners that if you ever want to hear some interesting stories, walk up to a cop and ask him, "Hey, what have you seen today that I haven't seen?"
Okay. Sarah, any few words, parting thoughts?
I'm so honored to have been here with Treva and Susanna. So thank you.
Thank you. You bet. Treva.
Yes. Thank you so very much for having us here. It's a pleasure meeting all of you. Thank you, Eric, for this opportunity. And I must say, I'm very proud to be a part of the Houston Police Department. And if you ever want to know more about us, please go to houstonpolice.org.
Okay. Thank you. Well, don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson Tapes. Make 90.1 a part of your everyday life. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or eating donuts with a cop, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story, and treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. Why, she's the best gal that I ever had. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the... If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT.
Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.
Listening to KPFT 90.1 FM Houston and online at kpft.org. Your local station board election is happening. Visit elections.pacifica.org to find out about the candidates, members.